This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a visit today with 93-year-old Joe Haritani of Sonora, California, a veteran of the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team during World War II. Eventually, roughly 14,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry served in that go-for-broke unit during the war. That group earned a total of nearly 9,500 Purple Hearts. Think about that statistic for a while. By the way, if your travels are going to take you to Los Angeles and that area over the next few weeks, there is a free exhibit of photographs, portrait-style photos, of 442nd veterans called Portraits of Courage by Shane Sato. It features 81 different Nisei vets, and it's in LA's little Tokyo district at the headquarters of the Go for Broke National Education Center through June 10th. I've got a link to that information up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But why don't we dive back into Joe Haritani's story? He'd been pulled out of college by Executive Order 9066 and sent to the Granada War Relocation Center in Colorado. From behind barbed wire there, he volunteered to serve the same country that was holding his family prisoner. By the first day of May in 1944, he was leaving Newport News, Virginia to sail across the Atlantic and into combat with the 442nd.
It was a large fleet, I think something like 90 ships, all going across the Atlantic to North Africa. We landed in Oran, and then we were put on British troop ship to go across the Mediterranean to Italy. And I remember they served us breakfast in a British ship, and it was fish and chips. And, you know, we couldn't take it. We just all threw it away. And we landed in Naples and marched up to a town called Grosseto, and from there we went into action, fought all the way up to Florence on the Florence River, and from there they shipped us out of Italy and shipped us in troop ships to Marseille, France, and went on trucks up to Belmont and went back into action in France.
And you were in a mortar platoon?
Yes, 81 milliliter mortars. There were three parts, the bipod, and then the mortar tube, and the base plate. And I ended up carrying the base plate. It weighed some, 45 pounds. It was kind of heavy, and it had the strap, so I could strap it to my back over my shoulder.
So you guys would have to find a spot to set that up, and then if it's time, if you're told fire at this location, what would you do? What was your job?
We made sure that we were under trees, because if the mortar shell hit a limb or something, it would bloom. I mean, it would explode right on our heads. So we had to move to clear areas. And I remember that our frontline infantry were lined up on a ridge of a hill, and they couldn't move because they're coming under artillery fire. And so we moved up behind them, and we started lobbing mortar shells into where the troops, the enemy troops, were coming. And we forced them to retreat and go back up so that our troops could move forward. Yeah, it was very effective. Those mortar shells are very dangerous, you might say.
And that's one of the things that makes you a target, too. The enemy would like to take you guys out and take out that mortar. And when you tell the story of Johnny Yamamoto and coming back and they won't let you see your best buddy's body, you said that was an artillery shell that hit the same location where you were before you left to go get those canteens. So what would have happened to you if you were still there?
I would have been gone. Yeah, because we were in the same slit trench, you know, right next to each other. So just lucky, I guess. Otherwise, I wouldn't have made it.
And I'm sure that wasn't the only close call that you experienced. In fact, at one point, you ended up with a little shrapnel inside of you as well?
Yeah, I think we were under artillery fire again, and artillery burst down below me and ducked my head, and shrapnel hit my helmet, but I got one little shrapnel in my chest, just like the tip of my finger, little finger. And I didn't even know it because, you know, you're in shock. And it was much later when I was off the line and going to take a shower. I noticed this little, like a scar, pull it, little piece of shrapnel. And I saved it for a long time. And finally, I don't know when I lost it.
You know, the 442nd has become legendary for the courage, for the bravery, also for the casualties. An inordinate number of casualties suffered by a unit that wasn't that big. So it must not have been a one-time situation. When you talk about Johnny Yamamoto, there must have been other friends who you lost over there too.
Oh, yes, because I would buddy up with another guy, Frank Shigemori. He was from Washington State, one of the few in our outfit from out of California. There weren't very many Japanese Americans in Washington or Oregon. Most of us were from California. Most of our company were from Hawaii.
When you guys made it to the Arno River, that's when Frank was killed?
The Arno, yeah. He was killed with artillery, yeah.
Well, and what about you and your mindset? Did you ever sit there in that foxhole and hear everything that was happening and wonder if you were going to make it?
No, we're just too busy trying to stay alive. I mean, we just hoped that you could see the next day, but we didn't really focus on being killed. It just happens, and you could do nothing about it. So we let it go at that.
And while you were over there in Italy and later in France, did you ever receive mail from your family back at the camp?
No, I never got a letter. I never wrote. I never received anything from my family or friends at all. I was just isolated, you might say, and not worried about family back home.
Was there something that you think helped you endure that, or that kept you going, or that motivated you during that difficult time?
Well, I just felt that, you know, life just goes on, and if your luck holds, you'll see the next day and the next day beyond that, and not worry about it. Basically, you just worried about getting your rations every day to keep alive and keep your water canteen so you can keep drinking water and staying alive. That was it. I mean, you didn't look at the whole big picture. You just thought about your own existence and your buddy's existence and just keep fit and ready to rejoin the battle whenever it took you to a new area.
Well, and I want to talk to you about one of those areas, Bruyere, and what you experienced there. But you know, on that topic we are just covering, I'm just curious, since your dad was a preacher and you grew up in church, did faith play a role at all for you? Did you have some expectation that God was on your side or would protect you?
No, I didn't feel that way at all. My dad did his Sunday service in Japanese, and there was a young people's service separately from our parents, and we had older second generation Japanese who taught us in church. I don't think we understood Japanese that well because we never used it.
So you guys, this is October 1944, you guys are in the area of Bruyere, France, and your battalion was told to take a hill? Hill B was your guy's target?
Yeah, we more or less crawled and took a position. I remember it started to rain. I had to dug a slit trench, and I put the tree limbs on the bottom to keep me out of the water because it was filling up with water. Yeah, but anyway, we were able to move forward from there.
Well, and it was not long after that that the 442nd had the incident that it has become most famous for, the rescue of the Lost Battalion, where so many of these Japanese American soldiers were wounded or even killed, rescuing some Caucasian soldiers, mostly from Texas. That rescue of the Lost Battalion and you weren't there for it, right?
Yeah, the Texans were trapped behind enemy lines. I think they're running short of ammunition because they've been there probably a couple of two or three days. So this is a Texas battalion. So the Texas division called us from where we were to come in and try to rescue them. We fought the Germans who were holding them captive and finally got the Germans to retreat because we were putting up a lot of fire, mortar fire and rifle fire. So we finally got the Texans back out and got them freed from beyond the lines.
Yeah, and we've heard from some of those rescuers as well as some of those who were rescued here on this program over the years. There were more than 800 go-for-broke soldiers from the 442nd who ended up being killed or wounded in the process of saving fewer than 250 of those men from the Lost Battalion. And who knows, perhaps you would have been one of those casualties, but you happened to be back in the hospital and missed that whole incident. And that's because of a back injury that still bothers you now and had flared up at the time. What happened there, Joe? How'd you hurt your back?
Oh, that was in training. I fell from... part of the training was to go climb up a tall wall, wooden wall, and I fell and hit my butt and squashed one of the vertebrae. So they sent me down to LaGuardia General Hospital in New Orleans, and they operated on my back on that spine.
So when you were over in Europe fighting, that would act up on you?
Oh, well, you know, I just got used to living with it, so I didn't even focus. I never even thought about it anymore.
But it flared up to the point where you had to go to a hospital?
Yeah, I had taken off the line somewhere along the way. And I remember going on a train and being treated for my spine, but I don't have any real specific recollection about that.
But before the war ended in Europe, you actually got transferred to another company handling oxygen cylinders?
It was a chemical company that produced oxygen for welding and also for breathing. I forget, there's some sort of chemical mixture, and by adding certain chemicals, oxygen gas would come out of that, would trap it into cylinders and send them to the hospital. It was a strange job.
Well, and it was probably different also because you go from a unit that's all Japanese American to now you're probably the only Japanese American with a bunch of Caucasians?
I was, actually. But one of the guys in the platoon or the squad that I was in, he was really cut up type of kid. He sort of made good friends with me, and I remember we would wrestle. I remember one time we were on these folding beds, you know, like camp beds that fold out. I guess I fell on that, and he jumped on top of me and just tore the fabric all in half. I fell down. Yeah, the strange things we did.
Did that take getting used to, serving with white soldiers after being segregated into the all Nisei unit?
No, they were very friendly. I remember going on leave with two Caucasian friends, and we went back down to, I think, northern coast of Italy, just taking sort of like, almost like a vacation.
And what about when the war ended, when you got news, hey, Germany has surrendered? What kind of feeling did that produce for you?
I was with this Caucasian. They call it a gas generation company producing oxygen gas. And I think we're actually not in the fighting. You know, we're always behind the line. So actually, it was no big change for us. Just to notice that the fighting was over. Yeah.
Well, and you were probably starting to think, hey, when do I get to go home, right?
But the thing is that, you know, home was no longer home because the whole family, all the others, were still in the concentration camps, in our case, in Colorado. So I think by that time, while I was still waiting to be discharged, they were finally able to go back to California, and my parents went back to the church and the parsonage in Livingston. And when I got discharged, they sent me from New England, flew me all the way to outside Marysville, California, where I got discharged. And I remember in my uniform, I had a pack sack. They had this, it was actually a civilian bus with a lot of veterans in it and also civilians. When I tried to get on, all the seats were taken. And the bus driver said, "We got to get out. There's no room." And the woman sitting on the front seat by the step said, "Let him sit here. Let him go." And so he let me sit on the steps there and closed the door, and we went and got back home. And I got off in Livingston and walked home. Knocked on the front door and surprised that my mother and father were there. My mother said, "There's a robber at the..." And he looked and said, "No, it's Joe." So that was our reunion, yeah.
And there's another layer to that I think we need to share with our listeners, but it's break time again. If you'd like to see what that robber, Joe, looked like in uniform during World War II, and of course what he looks like now, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll also explore his post-military duties in the U.S. Foreign Service and the impact that had. Hometown Heroes will come right back after this.